Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Tilly Steele.
And I'm Helen Monk.
And this is Bitchin'.
I'm dyslexic.
Yeah, why do you read the Wikipedia page?
It's good to practice.
A podcast where every week we talk about a different person.
So how old was he when he first popped on the scene?
That's a great
question. If you say he was my age, I'm gonna fucking die.
And we veer wildly off track.
Pop that Prosecco.
Available on all your podcast apps. That's not right. Just
can you not say in the advert?
Available on all your podcast platforms. Just search Bitchin' or Great Big Owl.
We'll see you there.
That was all right.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Pop craze youngsters, and welcome to the latest episode of Chart Music, the podcast that gets its hand right down the back of the settee on a random episode of Top of the Pops. I'm your host, Al Needham, but so fucking what? It's all about my guests. Not my guests, my fucking partners. How dare I deem these people as guests? Those people are Neil Kulkarni.
Hello there, Al.
And Taylor Parks.
Hello.
Boys! Team ATV land, if you will. You will tell me now of the pop and interesting things that have occurred of late.
Well, like most people and like most listeners, I'm sure, I've been losing my fucking mind of late. Going slowly mad. But one thing I've noticed is that I've heard from a lot of people that a kind of recurrent phrase, which is, oh, I've been saving a lot of money during lockdown. I've been kind of combating that of late by just buying utterly pointless shit off the internet.
Oh, yes.
I've already rotated through things that I can vaguely justify, you know. So I've bought a drum kit and I'm going to buy a keyboard, and I've joined the ranks of cheating guitarists by buying a capo as well. Ooh. But I'm now just getting daily packages of just pointless shit because, I mean, we're all spending, you know, dawn till dusk basically on our phones. And yeah. Where a lot of people are looking at 5G conspiracies, etc., I'm just looking at shit Facebook ads and buying pointless shit. So I now own a stethoscope.
Why?
Well, it's been a long held want, to be honest with you, that I've always wanted to listen to my stomach. you know, because it makes a lot of noise after whatever I've eaten, because I eat a lot of trash, and it's just tantalising. So I spent like 10 quid on a stethoscope, and now I've got to admit most of my evenings are spent listening to the it's like sort of Pierre Schaeffer produced by King Tubby, what goes on in my stomach.
Can you record it for us?
I'll give it a go, mate.
Yeah,
everyone should get one. There's symphonies going on inside of you. The body is an amazing sound factory. So that's one thing I've got, and one thing I've also got that I'm not wearing at the moment, perhaps I should have worn it, is a posture corrector. Look, it was an advert, it appealed, because I've spent my whole life getting slapped on the back by various women in my life telling me to stand up straight. And
lovely boy.
Yeah, this is it.
So of course, this thing, by the music industry generally. Well done, Neil, we appreciate it.
Yeah, so this is like this sort of humiliating harness that you put yourself in. And the trouble is you can't actually put yourself in it yourself. So you do have to ask somebody to strap you in to a certain extent, a process that repulses my daughter immensely. But it do, I've got to say, it does work.
I've got to put my dad's reverse bra on every morning.
Well, quite. It does work. It has been making me stand up straight. It does have like 47 years of slouching to battle. So it's going to take some time. And obviously, within a couple of hours, chafing issues are paramount. But I think it works. It hurts anyway.
Oh, it must work then if it hurts.
It must be working. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. Pointless shit off the internet.
I bought one of those the other week.
I did. We're their target demographic, Al.
And I'm wearing it now.
You're wearing it?
Yes. Just a spate of photos popped up on Facebook of me sitting in pubs back in the olden times.
Mm.
And I'm like a fucking Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle and not in a good way, man. I'm just hunched over like a fucking poisoned rat. I'm just thinking, oh, well, this is not going to get me any sexy lady action, is it? Looking like this. So I thought, you know.
This was my thoughts as well. Before I went full quasi, you know, yeah. I just wanted to stand up straight. And I must admit, when I put it on for the first time, it's like, oh, blooming heck, I am tall, aren't I?
Yes.
Look at the height up here.
Look at my perky breasts.
It's weather. I mean, the key thing is, good on you, Alpha, having it on right now. I've got to admit, I haven't had it on today. So I've got to make that daily sacrifice.
Are you going
to
go out in public with it on?
I've already been out in public with it on. Because I know you can wear it outside your garments, which looks a bit foolish as far as I'm concerned.
Well, just imagine that you've got a gun strapped to you on the inside, Neil.
It very much has got that Travis Bickle thing to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, but no, I've been keeping it underneath garments, which obviously changes what you can wear, because just a simple T-shirt can reveal this strange man bra thing.
Yes.
So you've got to be careful. But yeah, I've got to stay dedicated to it, Al. We can be posture corrector buddies,
yes,
and gee each other up on this score.
Yeah, form a bubble.
Yes.
That's all the rage.
Taylor, yeah. You were loaned out, weren't you, the other week to the One Show.
Yeah, but it means nothing.
Well done, mate. Right, excellent performance.
Yeah, I haven't heard it yet.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
Oh, well,
I don't like the sound of my own voice, you know.
You were fucking brilliant, Tony, mate. Jeez. Didn't fucking plug chart music, though, did
you? Well, I told them to do it. I thought it'd be...
The whole point of the fucking thing.
Did they not mention it?
Taylor, that was your job.
Was it?
Yes!
Oh. I thought it'd be a bit unseemly.
At no point did I hear you banging a drum shouting chartmusic.co.uk.
Well...
That's the whole point of these things. Actually, me, you and David are on the When Saturday Comes podcast pretty soon, aren't we? For the 400th issue of When Saturday Comes.
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned chart music quite a lot, actually.
Well, good.
Well done, Al.
Yeah.
Cross-platform brand synergization.
Exactly.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. I'm surprised I could remember anything, to be honest. I cannot tell a lie. I'm starting to go a bit mad now, being locked down this long. People moan that they've completed some box set. Right, I think I'm now on the verge of completing YouTube, which I'm less proud of than I should be, really. I've gone past all the stuff I used to watch, like, you know, weather forecasts from 1979 and, like, footage of old caravan sites and stuff. A lot of the stuff that is apparently enjoyed by the general public. And now I understand what's happened to the world over the last 10 years or so. Because this is brain rot is completely hypnotic, and it gets ever more soothing as life around us deteriorates. Right, first I got into watching these videos called things like Americans React to British Snacks.
Oh.
There's like an epidemic of this. It's just endless clips of non-personalities sat in their kitchen with bags of Monster Munch going like, oh my God, I heard about Cadbury chocolate. And they get everything wrong. You can't reach through the screen to correct
shake them.
Yeah, you just have to sit watching them eating digestives without a cup of tea. You know what I mean? They've just got a little bottle of water there. Mm. They're going, oh, it's kind of dry. It's like, yeah, but it's because it's like you're eating a cup of soup without any water in it. It's... The best or the worst was this lad who got really excited about Ribena because they don't have black currants in America. I found out they were banned until the 60s because they can carry a fungus which wipes out pine trees. So it saved the American timber industry. They banned black currants. And then when that ban was lifted in the 60s, they never caught on. So they don't have Ribena in America. So this kid's there going, I've heard about this stuff. Oh, I can't wait to try it. And he just takes the lid off and starts chugging it. He drinks about a quarter of a bottle and then he wipes his lips and goes, whoa, that's sweet.
And the thing I hate about it, they've all got the same sort of screen grab on the front, which is an American person looking absolutely gobsmacked by, I don't know, Clopper Castle.
I know. Well, the thing is, you don't get anything out of it. Because, like, we all sort of, I want to see what... It's this sort of a narcissistic, like, Derek Jameson, do they mean us?
Yeah.
They surely do. Like, you want to know what... So it appeals to all your worst instincts, right? Mm. You want to hear what people are saying about you. Mm. But you get nothing, because these people have got nothing to contribute. Mm. And you realise that whatever anyone says about the democratisation of opinion, the democratisation of criticism is a terrible thing.
Mm.
And the end point of that is just me sat in my house watching a couple of twats eating hobnobs in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I'm waiting for this articulation of their culinary culture shock. And all they ever say, they eat it and then they go, that's pretty good. Don't forget to click like on the video, subscribe to my channel. Here's my Patreon. And it's like the internet has brought the whole world into my front room, cap in hand.
Yeah.
And they're boring. And then you look at the thing underneath and it says like 908,000 subscribers.
I know.
They're going, now let's get it up to a million. Like as if we're all in this together. Right?
Yeah.
Come on, everyone. We can get it up to a million.
A million people watching an American eating a biscuit.
Yeah.
We do a podcast which is essentially British people react to an old episode of Top of the Pops. But for fuck's sake, we're a bit better than that, surely.
Yeah, at least we're not just sitting there eating in front of people.
No. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And I moved on from that to those Americans Visit London clips where like it's just like homemade travelogues of people's holidays. Mm. And I'm thinking, okay, they've got nothing to say about curly whirlies, but maybe it will be more exciting. Because, I mean, neither have I. Let's face it. So let's see if they got something more interesting to say about the city. But no, because they only stay in Zone 1, which nowadays is not really London. It's like England World.
Mm. Yes.
It's like done up like a Harry Potter theme park for tourists because that's the only thing Americans associate with Britain now. And it's the only thing they're interested in. Mm. So I just spent all these hours watching shitty-looking, juddering phone footage of grey skies and stuff and with this terrible stock piano music tinkling away underneath because they think it makes it look more professional. So I have like this horrendous MIDI fake piano noodling. And again, they got nothing to contribute. They go to Westminster Abbey and they go, oh, well, there it is. It's like, I could have experienced this myself by typing Westminster Abbey into Google Images, then shaking the screen a bit while on hold to a provincial nursing home. And the only thing they're interested in, they go to King's Cross fucking station to look at a sign on the wall announcing a platform which doesn't even exist. And they go to Nando's. That's the other thing. They've heard about it. They're really excited. They go, guys, I'm super excited. We're going to Nando's. It's like people from New Orleans where you get better chicken than that out of a bin. You know what I mean? They think it's fucking amazing.
Obviously, what you need to do, Taylor, is set up your own YouTube channel called Taylor Parks Reacts to Americans Reacting to Things.
Yeah, it's just a photograph of me with no expression. And the mouth moves and it goes, click like on the video.
It does seem to be mainly one way, those videos, i.e. Americans reacting to our stuff and Americans not being that fussed about our reaction to their stuff.
Because they know what we're going to tell them. It's a fucking COD and it's shit.
Yeah.
It is our worst instincts. It's that neediness that we had. I mean, with that Derek Jameson program, it's the same thing. We need that validation still.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be honest with you, it's that worst instinct that I think is also appealed to with that genre of YouTube videos where it's,
I don't know, young black hip-hop fan listens to Pink Floyd for the first time.
Yes.
You know, those videos. Oh, wow, a black person likes white music. Wow, isn't that delightful and delicious?
Yeah, and it's blown away by the musicianship.
Yeah, and you never get videos called White Indie Fan Reacts to Sly and the Family Stone.
No.
Just, well, they don't, obviously they don't have the melodic sophistication. The thing about those videos, though, the kids in those videos are shrewd because they've worked something out, which is that most white rock fans, or a lot of white rock fans, don't have any black friends, but they would like some because they're not racist. They just don't know any black people.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've also worked out that secondarily, if those people did have black friends, the first thing they would want to do with their black friends is play them white rock music of the 60s, 70s, and to a lesser extent, 80s and 90s. Oh. What do you think of that then? What's gone? What, listen to this one.
The one I'd love to see on YouTube is Jamaicans reacting to reggae like it used to be and the Doolins. That would be fucking amazing, wouldn't it?
But I can't slag this stuff off too much because it's I'm surviving on that and Four Roses bourbon, which is a really nice drink. Little known fact, Four Roses bourbon actually named in honor of the pop group Vanilla, who shyly captured the hearts of a nation.
As in No Way, No Way.
Manomano.
Yeah, don't get fresh with them.
No. Is that true?
Of course it's not fucking
true. All right.
Unless they're around in 1883 as the bottle. Oh,
okay, all right. I don't fucking know. Boast. I don't know anything anymore in this crazy new normal. One thing I do know, however, that this is the moment in the episode where we stop, we drop, we bow the knee, and we praise to the skies the latest batch of Pop Craze Patreon people. And this month, those people are, in the $5 section, David English, Wang Chung Lung, Simon Wagstaff, Steve Duffer, Michael Burke, Chris Durden, Dave Caffrey, Mike Conyard, Ross Hawkins, George Schilling, Rich Simiska, Phil Bolton, Colin Callanish, Parso, Chitanka Dodwala, Emily McQuaid, Anthony Stenson, Mark Lasua, Simon Rooks, Sivi Negrick, and Andy McLeod. Thank you, babies.
Oh, yeah.
Go on then, thank
them. Thank you. It's amazing to hear Michael Burke taking a break from his moral maze duties to throw $5 down our G-string. Mm. Thank you, Michael. Yeah.
Not the first time he's tried to help out starving people.
And in the $3 section, we have Gordy McNair, Tim Daler, David Cray, Alistair Brown, and Mark Lewis. Your names are down, and you are coming in. And Doug Grant and Matt Verrill, you are getting special thanks for jacking your donation up and above and over and beyond the odds.
Whoa.
Yeah, you get to come in the back one.
Yes. So, if you want to join those lovely special people and you want the full episode of Chart Music in one go without having to listen to adverts for piss pads and God knows what else, you get them little fingers over to the keyboard, you step up to the pay window, you tap in patreon.com/chartmusic and you pledge. Do you get them adverts? When I listen to Chart Music on Acast, I always get the piss pad adverts. It's really unsettling.
I don't get the piss pad ones, no.
Yeah, you're a younger generation to me, you see. You're still in your 40s.
No, I think it's already been sorted, mate, because back when Tenor Men were giving away free samples, my children thoughtfully applied for a box for me, which arrived. How kind of them. I've kept them, obviously, because they're going to be useful at some point.
Nosebleeds and whatnot.
I'm pissing myself. It's not that far away.
Well, yeah, that too, yeah. Yeah. It's worrying, though, man. I mean, the advertising algorithms on my own fucking podcast keep telling me to stop pissing myself, and I don't. My bladder is tight as a drum, Pop Craze youngsters. Everyone assumes that the minute you wake up on your 50th birthday, your mattress is awash with piss.
Did you get
it's
your free pen?
Awful, man. Sorry?
Did you get your free pen with your life insurance plan when you hit 50? Because that's
no,
that is fucking what I'm looking
no.
forward to. Oh, I'm going to get that done.
And people start asking about your fucking funeral as well. Have you planned for your funeral yet? It's like, No, I'll be dead. I don't give a fuck. Chuck me in the bin wagon. I don't give a toss.
Yeah, I was impressed the day after all the coronavirus stuff got really serious. I just started getting adverts on my Facebook telling me to make a will. Mm. It's like, I'm at Facebook, you don't know me as well as you think. Make a will. For what? Cast lots.
And, of course, all those Pop Craze Patreons get to tinker with the latest Chart Music Top 10. Shall we have it, chaps?
Oh, yes, please.
Hit the fucking music! We've said goodbye this week to the English Rock Defence League, Lion Bellend, the Bummers Conga, and last week's number one, Chip Pans People, which means one up, four down, one no change, and four new entries. Down two places from number 8 to number 10, it's Dave D, Creeper, Twat, and Cunt. It's a three-place drop for this week's number 9, Jeff Sex. Last week's number 2, this week's number 8, Romo Ralph Wiggum. Down from number 4 to number 7, here comes Jism.
Dinosaur.
Going up four places from number 10 to number 6, Lesbian Door Factory.
Ooh, okay.
The first new entry of the week comes straight in at number 5, Flaky Pastry. A new entry at number 4, Frumpy Pumpy.
Whoa.
Into the top 3, and no change for Bummer Dog. In at number 2, it's a new entry for Dusty Shelbyville, which means...
Britain's number 1.
The highest new entry, and this week's Chart Music number 1, Spiteful Armoured Bollock.
Wow.
Oh, what a chart that is.
Very eventful. So many new entries. Yeah. So many new entries.
Yeah.
Turbulent times.
Recognition at last for Flaky Pastry. Didn't want to come into the Top of the Pop studio, though, because it was a bit too far out for them.
Mm. Yeah. Great musicianship. They don't take themselves too seriously either.
Frumpy Pumpy. Well, obviously, you know, Legs and Co. if Hyacinth Bouquet was every member. Dusty Shelbyville. Well, there we go.
Yeah.
And Spiteful Armour Bollock, that's proper doom metal, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't... Mm.
Industrial.
Novelty hit. Just cash it in.
They've got a band logo that you just can't read. And when you do decipher it, it says something else entirely.
Yeah, with an umlaut on the O in Bollock.
Which one, though?
Oh, they're all good.
Yeah. So this episode, Pop Craze Youngsters, takes us all the way back to February the 14th, 1985. Oh, we've walked down this road before, haven't we, Neil?
We have, yeah.
We were confronted by Opus. It's fair to say that all of a sudden, in the no man's land between Band Aid and Live Aid, we're being bombarded with pop at this time, aren't we?
Yeah, we're up to our necks in it.
There's Whistle Test, which has been moved to mid-evening and has knobbed off all the beardy progos for, you know, more pop artists. The rock and roll year starts in 1985, so does the Golden Oldie Picture Show.
Oh, great.
Over on ITV, there's Razzmatazz for the kiddies. If you turn the knob to Channel 4, you know, the Tube's in its third series. There's also The Other Side of the Tracks with Paul Gambaccini, ESA with Nicky Horn and Gary Crowley. We're not too far away from the Roxette and the Chart Show. Mm. So, you know, Top of the Pops is getting a bit crowded there for a minute.
Well, very much so. And that's exactly what this episode shows, I think. It's mad, this episode. And you know,
it really is.
Kind of the previous episode that we saw from 85, I came out of it with my traditional opinion intact, i.e. that 85 is a fucking horrible year, you know, much like 75, much like all these mid-decade points tend to be. In a weird way, this episode, I know we always have this argument on Chart Music, best year for pop, and I'm certainly not going to start arguing that 85 was a great year for pop, but in a way, I would almost show this as an episode that exemplifies all that's great and shit about the 80s in a way more than, say, an episode from 81 or 82. Because episodes from 81, they're all full of good stuff, and that's not really what it was like. This episode gets that perfect balance of being a pop fan, i.e. stuff that you're rapturous about, but lots of stuff that you feel betrayed by, angry about, and annoyed about. And it's a really interesting episode.
Yeah, it's like 1984 was the hinge between the early 80s and the bad 80s. But 1985, it was when the bad 80s really kicked in, but there's still a fair bit of good music in the charts, and certainly in this particular Top of the Pops. But it's funny how much of that good music feels like a bit of a holdover. It's like it's following trails which were laid post-punk and were about to be blasted into oblivion. There's not a lot of great 1985 music that is unmistakably 1985 music, like something new, you know. But it was a weird time, wasn't it? It was a weird time. I mean, I remember this period really well. And I mean, I was 12 when this episode went out and deeply entrenched in my newfound opinions. And this period is really sharp in my memory, and it really did feel like the end of the old world. Like on the one hand, you had the end of the miners' strike, which is about a fortnight away at this point, which made it clear that those old dreams were over and done with. And on the other hand, this was also the last possible moment that you could sort of wear a navy blue blazer on Concord with a pocket square and sip champagne. You know what I mean? It's that old kind of success, right? It was everything was changing beyond recognition, and the new rules were being set in socio-political terms by Thatcherism and in cultural terms by America. Yeah. And you see a lot of it in this. The good stuff tends to be the dying embers of the British pop boom of the early 80s. And a lot of the bad stuff is blowing in across the Atlantic. The only consolation at the time was that that particular 70s bleakness was finally going away, right? And it's not that the mid-80s weren't a bleak time, but it was different, right? In terms of what things looked and smelt like, there was an improvement. And British food was just beginning its slow climb towards acceptability. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Britain was going backwards on social issues and stuff, but it was also becoming a less insular and less old-fashioned place. In a lot of other
ways. This was the time when pasta was an actual food item in a British kitchen as opposed to a display object in a jar.
And you'd see a baguette and stuff like that. You know what I mean? But there was a trade-off because...
hang on, Taylor. French stick?
French
stick. Yeah.
But there was a trade-off because, on the one hand, you had this feeling that even if you were poor, you no longer felt like you were living in an Eastern Bloc country. But on the other hand, you no longer felt like you were living in a culture of ideas. Do you know what I mean? Like that had gone. That was finished. That post-war wave of socially, politically and artistically radical thought was over. And from now on, the essential Philistinism of Britain was no longer one side of a culture war. It was a culture. And after this, you could do great things as an individual, but it wouldn't be part of anything bigger. You would just do it and go home.
And as far as Top of the Pops goes round about this time, I mean, it's settled down a bit from the Yellow Hurl era. The event-driven aspect of Top of the Pops, it seems to be finally behind us because this is Valentine's Day, but we're not going to get Dave Lee Travis hanging from the fucking lighting gantry with a bow and arrow, thank fuck. But it's fair to say, and, you know, we've got to say this right now, if you thought the last episode was long pop craze, youngsters, wait till you fucking get this one. We have got a very long day ahead of us, let me tell you. Because Top of the Pops are just throwing the fucking kitchen sink at this episode, aren't they?
Yeah,
everything's in there. It's jam-packed. You really didn't know there was so much in it.
It's going to be a long... It's really hot and sunny outside. I'm sat with all the curtains closed, sat with all the windows shut to keep the noise of kids outside from coming in. It's like by the time we finish this, I'm going to look like Al Pacino halfway through Dog Day Afternoon. If he was going rather grey.
So let's not fanny about pulp crazed youngsters. Avante!
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G-spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
Green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The sex doctor's guide to keeping it hot.
Ah, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great eps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Radio 1 News. In the news this week, the civil servant Clive Pontin is about to resign from the Ministry of Defence after leaking documents about the sinking of the Belgrano.
Now you remember resignations?
Yeah.
Them are the days.
Meanwhile, Michael Heseltine, the current Defence Secretary, is pelted with flour, eggs and stink bombs at Glasgow University. Staff at a hospital in Dulwich are instructed to burn their work clothes and have blood tests after an aged patient is discovered in a ward. Ian Botham has been fined £100 at Scunthorpe Crown Court for possession of 2 grams of cannabis.
Quite right, disgraceful.
The first prosecution for driving a Sinclair C5 whilst under the influence of alcohol has taken place in Whitehall. Well, someone got really pissed and thought it was a good idea to buy a C5.
Yeah. They shouldn't prosecute that bloke because, let's face it, he was only endangering himself.
The death watch for Konstantin Chernenko ramps up when a prominent Soviet heart doctor cut short a visit to Cleveland. He would die 3 weeks later. George Best is denied a day out from fraud open prison by the governor to appear in a video for Junior's latest single, which features Junior having a five-a-side match with the likes of Osvaldo Ardiles, Glenn Hoddle and Garth Crooks.
It all sounds like he's actually picking up a blank passport for Inky Stevens under the auspices of Genial Harry Grout, but I'm sure it was all above board.
Definitely, yes. An episode of the LWT show South of Watford, which concentrates on leather and rubber fetish wear shops with scenes of arse whipping and whatnot, has been pulled at the last minute by John Burt as he feels it's a bit too strong for Londoners. Dick James, on behalf of the writers of the Barry Manilow single Can't Smile Without You, are suing George Michael for ripping the tune off for the recent Wham single Last Christmas. The case is later settled out of court. But the big news this week is that rumours continue to persist about a satellite link-up concert, tentatively called Live Aid, to take place on June the 6th at Wembley Arena and Madison Square Gardens.
Yeah, sounds like it's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
If only that had happened.
On the cover of Melody Maker this week, Mick Jagger. On the cover of Smash Hits, The Power Station. The number one LP in the UK at the moment is Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. And over in America, the number one single is Careless Whisper by George Michael. And the number one LP is Like a Virgin by Madonna. So, boys, what were we doing in February of 1985?
Well, I think our age, Taylor, because I was 12 as well when this episode came out. And you know, like you, I'm sure, I was an appallingly precocious little cunt. But what's also becoming apparent to me in 85 is that I'm becoming entirely, at least culturally, colonised by American stuff, from telly to literature to film to music. Right. And film changes its nature anyway at this point, not because of the films being made, but because we have video shops now. And a lot of us have video, you know, recorders. And also because we're, I don't know, I was 12 going on 13, I was moving away from kind of shared cultural experiences to solitary cultural experiences, basically. I wasn't listening to music or watching films with people that much. Do you know what I mean? Or through the conduit of my elder sister. It was more accessing stuff myself, way more. And that ties in really with, it was a latchkey year for me. My parents were working a lot, 85. So a very latchkey life, and getting ourselves out and getting yourselves through three bus journeys to school and everything, to getting yourselves home and everything. And you'd spend a lot of time alone. I mean, I remember Christmas Day 85. I didn't even see my parents till about 8 o'clock at night because they were both working.
What, were they elves or
something? No. My dad was working away on Christmas Day, and my mum just had the day and night shift at the old people's home. So I just didn't see her much that day. And I just remember waking up. I got Sly and the Family Stone, There's a Riot Going On, for my present.
Fucking hell, get you, Neil.
Oh, I was a stuck up little bastard. But I mean, look, you know, I remember waking up and eating an entire box of Just Brazils before about 8 o'clock in the morning, and then just throwing up for the rest of the day. So, you know, at that age, I didn't want to hang around with my sister. And as a 16-year-old, she definitely didn't want to hang out with me.
It's a family affair. I didn't like Just Brazils because it was just like more nut and less chocolate.
Yeah, but they're lovely, man.
When your mum was wrapping up the Just Brazils for Christmas, Neil, did she nick one and then push the remainder together like in the other?
Oh, God, yeah. No, she didn't. No, she wrapped them up completely.
Good for her.
Truth be told, they weren't for me. They were just for the house. But I ended up scoffing the lot and just throwing up for the rest of the day. So, yeah. But, I mean, that's the thing. Age 12, 13, you know, you are making your identity at that point. So the library, the record shop, all of these places become hugely important. And new bits of the record shop and new bits of the library open up to you a little bit. So it's a really, you know... normally early 80s episodes, even though, you know, I was cognizant, obviously I was in double figures in terms of my age, it's still a bit foggy for me, whereas 85's crystal clear because I remember becoming, in a sense, who I am. And also, you make that decision, you don't know you make that decision, but you kind of make that decision when you're 12, 13 as to who you're kind of going to be. I don't mean job-wise, I just mean you decide, right, I'm going to stand a little bit off to the side here. Do you know what I mean? I'm not going to belong, I'm going to look at old stuff, etc. So very, very important year, 85. As reflected in this episode, it brought back a hell of a lot of memories.
Mm. Yeah, it was a big year for me as well, because it was the year we moved down south. And although this was already happening in Kidderminster, that sort of put the seal on it, that this was like the time when we properly made the leap from upper working class to lower middle class.
Through the barricades.
Yeah, well, people often think those two things are the same, right? When you say upper working class, low, like it's C sharp and D flat, you know, like it's the same note, but it just called different things depending on which angle you're looking at it from. It's not. There's a big difference between those two social groups. It's just not, and this is key, just not as big a difference as people making that jump themselves used to believe. I mean, upper working class really just meant we didn't live in a council house, Newman knives and forks, and we had a colour telly and a painting on the wall. It was two leopard cubs with their mother. Painting by an unnamed artist. And then all of a sudden, like, there were more books in the house, some read, some not. We switched from the Sun to the Daily Mail. Plates from the Franklin Mint began appearing on the Welsh dresser.
What was on them?
That was somewhere. Just... there was a Chelsea flower show, I think, like flowers right. from the Chelsea flower show. And then
so what Elvis then?
No, 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 no. That would have been a downward move, Al.
Yes. and the
leopard cubs were replaced with a cheap print of Turner's "The Fighting Temeraire," tugged nice. To her last birth to be broken up, which is a painting I can't even glance at now without a shudder, having spent so long staring into that golden sky while trying to blot out the sound of another bollocking from my parents. But it's an interesting class jump to make. It's the most common class jump to make, even now when social mobility is very restricted. And if you're a passenger in a family that does it and you've got your eyes open, it teaches you quite a lot about quite a lot, including the fact that money is not the key to it. Because we had less money after we moved down south, even though my dad was getting paid more, for the simple reason that we had to sell our house in Kidderminster and move into another new build semi-detached house on an estate, which was almost identical but cost twice as much because it was in the southeast. So all the money went on the mortgage for years and years and years. We were completely skint. So, the intricacies of the English class system became one of several things I got obsessed with around the age of 13. And like all those other things, in the end, it did me no good at all.
Paintings of big cats, man. That's really. I had the tiger one, two tiger cubs and its mum.
Yeah.
everyone had these things. But it's that point. They disappear, those things. They just stop. They just stop being seen, yeah.
But I always knew, right, even before we started putting on airs, I always knew that we were just one notch on the social chart above my nan, because she had a picture of big cats. But at least ours was finished as though it was a real painting, whereas hers, the cats were made out of velvet, like or probably velour, sort of on like a almost like a fuzzy felt. You know what I mean? It was like a fuzzy felt board, so I want to put a frame around and hung it on the fucking wall. And I remember thinking, this is something that we would no longer do as a household, hang that on the wall.
I'm trying to think about what paintings we had in our house, and nothing.
Green lady.
I mean, if it didn't come off the round, my dad was still a removal man.
Yeah.
And so if something was being lobbed out at the house he was moving out, he'd bring it back. I think the only ornament he brought back was a plaster moccasin bottle that he got off the round, and he actually wanted it in the house. And my mum was dead against it. And then he tried to put it in the garden, and she was absolutely dead set against that as well. So he ended up getting lobbed out when he was at work.
Mm.
And then he was going out one morning, and the bin wagon came round, and it had the moccasin bottle on the front grill of the van, and he was furious. And the only new things we had in the house at this time were all technology, you know, a video recorder, which meant the only thing that looked like books in our house was those videotape cases.
Oh, yeah.
That looked like old books.
Oh, yeah.
With a sheet of gold leaf so you could write, I don't know, Bottle Boys Series 2 on it or something like that. And a microwave.
Right.
You know, a resolutely working class family. No time for fripperies.
Oh, yeah.
If you can't record Only Fools and Horses or Cookie Tea a bit faster, we weren't interested.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think my parents used this time to reassert their cultural identity a bit, because I remember Indian stuff starting to turn up on my walls. Not my walls, but the walls of the house a bit more. A few more weird goddesses with 20 heads. And
they're brilliant though.
Yeah, and a few more dancing ladies, embroidered ladies with their tits out, things like that. So
excellent.
Yeah.
I remember going around my Asian mate's house for the first time when I was about 7, and they had all that stuff on the wall, and I thought it was fucking brilliant.
It is great. I mean, you know,
so why have we got this in our house?
Well,
like elephants with big swords fucking killing people.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Well, quite. And women with like 8 arms riding on tigers.
Yeah.
Decapitating people. Yeah, all of that imagery is fantastic. And you know, I can drive up Folsom Road now and buy those images untouched, uncut, unchanged. That is a style of art that has remained the same forever.
Oh, you just...
And rightfully
you
so.
Just reminds me of something. When I was about, I think, 14, and I was into, like, psychedelic music and stuff, I got one of these... I can't remember where I got it from. And it was like, yeah, it was like a guy riding a chariot pulled by like eight tigers or something through the clouds. And I put it on the wall of my bedroom. And about 2 days later, my dad sat me down to give me a talk about how I shouldn't take drugs.
Quite right.
I had that as well with my dad, but it was because I had a red light bulb. He came back from the pub and went fucking mental. Says, a fucking, you're making the house look like a fucking knocking shop. You're on drugs.
Red light bulbs, you could get them. Yeah. And they did add that little tinge of exotica to your room. Yeah.
Yeah, if you weren't going to be allowed joss sticks or patchouli oil in the house, then a red light bulb. Strange times.
Strange times.
I'm still at sixth form. Well, I say I'm at sixth form, but I'm bunking off by now. I'm just aimlessly wandering the wastelands of Top Valley, Nottingham. Just felt an absolutely shit time to be 16. You know, I'm being constantly told not to do drugs or have sex while I'm not finding any drugs or any sex lying about. Just basically walking about in a green MA1 flight jacket with a Cold Up Doll sticker, wondering what the fuck I was supposed to be doing. You know what I mean? This was supposed to be the golden years of my life. Mm, and it's like, well, is something going to happen now?
Did you have a look you were going for in 85, Al? Because this is something that I was trying to remember what I was aiming for. I mean, I was only bloody 12, but...
Well, I was still just about the last mod in Nottingham at this time. Right. So all I was wearing really was the stuff I'd bought from London because I'd be going on me excursions. The highlight of my life at this time was round about just after Christmas and just after my birthday, where I'd just rake up as much money as I could, go down to London in the morning and spend all day there just buying clothes and stuff that I couldn't get in Nottingham.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I can actually see myself now wearing like these dog tooth check trousers from Carnaby Street or the Prince of Wales check one, a pair of black loafers or, no, the Oxblood loafers. I got them first from that shop where Madness got their dogs. I'm wearing a green jacket with a Cole Knot doll sticker on one side. And then later on, I'd have a Tampa Bay Buccaneers patch on the left-hand side because I really liked American football. I was obsessed by it. And wearing one of the two Judge Dredd T-shirts I had at the time, which didn't feature Judge Dredd on them. One of them was Pug Ugly and the Buglies, the punk band, and it had Get Ugly over the top. And the other one I wore, I think it was later on actually, was Arnold Stodgman, who was a champion eater who died during the World Eating Championships, which of course was illegal.
Yeah.
He died because he went for the ton. He tried to eat a ton of food when there was no need to. And he saw this massive pie and he just said, give me the pie. And his manager said, no, you don't need to. And he said, I said, give me the pie. And so he had a T-shirt of Arnold Stodgman, this big fat fucker with all just food coming right down his chin and onto his chest.
Oh, mate.
And in a Frankie Goes to Hollywood style, it said underneath, Arnie say, give me the pie. So that was me at the time.
It's a shame he didn't survive. They could have put him on at Live Aid.
Yes. It's
been about as tasteful as Bob Geldof's performance.
Yes.
It was always a thrilling bit of the Guinness Book of Records, the eating record stuff, because it was always mention of trencher men. Like we were meant to know who they were or what that meant. A trencherman's appetite. At least your ensemble, though, Al, that sounds vaguely coordinated.
Yeah, kind of.
Because I was confused. Obviously, I was only 12. So you'd wear this shit that your parents got you, i.e. like a jacket with turbo on the sleeve or something like that. But I'd combine it with just bright ideas that I'd get from a pop video or something. So I'd watch some pop video, or I'd even watch fucking Wimbledon, and I'd like the idea of headbands. So I'd grab one of my dad's ties, tie it around my head, and go into town like that. And what the fuck was I thinking? But ho-hum.
I had a pair of those Prince of Wales check Carnaby Street trousers, but the cut wasn't very good on them. So I thought I was going to look like one of the Small Faces, but I actually looked like one of the black and white Doctor Whos.
I really wished I had an older brother at this time to just show me what to do, or at the very least, hand me down things. Mm. I think when I was about 10 or 11 and getting bullied at school, I started putting around that I had an imaginary older brother who was fucking rock. He was called Andy, And I actually put it around the playground that he was so hard, he was the only white man who was allowed into the Gurkhas. So, yeah, I really needed Ander, the imaginary older brother at this time.
How bizarre. My cousin, at this time, he wrote a piece about his family for his school. They were asked to write a piece about their family. And he created this sister that he had called Doris. And he's called Hershad, and his actual brother's called Sundeep. You know, good Indian name. So where he came up with Doris from, fuck only knows. But yeah, fantasy siblings, it must have been a thing.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't a problem for my sister. She knew what to do. You know, she'd just basically hang around with lads who had nice Ticini tracksuit tops and kind of like get them off them.
I'm cold.
Yeah. Right about this time, actually, my mum got it into her that she would get some tracksuit tops made for her and her best mate. And they were both called Tracer. And whoever made it made the absolute fucking error of doing their own logo, which was a T in a circle. And my sister went fucking mental. I can't wear this. People think I've got a knockoff Ticini tracksuit.
Yeah.
And my mum couldn't understand. So there was a good week where I was just sitting in the living room minding my own business while my little sister and my mum were just screaming abuse at each other because neither could understand.
Yeah.
This is the time when I'm aware of labels, but it seems to be something that everyone else is doing. Everyone else is getting Lacoste shirts and Sergio Ticini and Le Coq Sportif. It's the age of the head bag, isn't it?
Yes.
In a big way. But I stuck religiously to my little rucksack and I never got anything labelled up, unfortunately. No. I had the shit Asda alternatives instead.
I mean, music-wise, I'm already digging into the second-hand record shops and record fairs, but I'm just casting around just for anything that wasn't Radio 1 or Radio Trent or everything. I mean, by this time, I was even listening to Laser 558. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember a big article in Smash Hits about how they were going to take over from Radio 1 because they were so amazing. And then when you actually listen to it, they played the same records as Radio 1. It was just the same.
It was a very Dave Lee Travis-like playlist, wasn't it? I mean, the idea was that, you know, it was much more music and the DJs didn't prattle on. But the only reason people wanted to listen to it was to hear American DJs and stuff. I bought one of these massive radios out of a Daily Mirror classified that could pick up, you know, it was a really powerful radio that picked up stations all over the world in the vague hope that I'd be able to pick up, you know, American radio or something, which of course never happened. So, you know, you'd listen to Radio Moscow and, you know, all that kind of stuff just because it was something else. And then Laser 558 came along. It's like, oh, I'll listen to this. And you would hear a lot of Prince. They were massively into Prince.
Yeah.
But along with all the Prince, you would also get a lot of Eric Clapton and all this 70s American soft rock shit that I really wasn't into. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
I think in general, there was just more available. In comparison to the cultural glut that we can all sort of access now, it was nothing. But video definitely made a difference to me. And 85, I mean, 85 is also the year, I think I said previously, where albums start bossing my listening a bit more than singles. So it's all about Frankie and The Cure that year to a big extent. But also radio listening beyond Laser 558. I'm starting now that my radio listening is in the evening, not just on a Sunday after the chart. So you know, I am starting to listen to things like Janis and Peely and stuff like that, which is expanding things a lot.
I mean, I'm looking now at the 1985 wing of my record collection, and, oh, it's very sparse indeed. There's, you know, Our Favourite Shop by the Style Council, Rum Sodomy and the Lash by the Pogues, a Go-Go compilation, 19 by Paul Hardcastle, Strike by the Enemy Within, and a couple of Redskin singles.
Yeah, I think I bought my first few 12 inches that year, 85.
It's a poor crop.
Yeah, but I bet you, Al, there was shit tons of stuff, old stuff, that you were listening to in 85, because 85 was so rubbish in a lot of ways.
I mean, Radio by LL Cool J comes out this year.
It does.
But it would be a good year before I picked up on it, so... You know, there's good shit happening in 1985, but it's not getting into my tab.
Yeah, but Al, seriously, how many people in this country knew about LL Cool J or Schoolie D? Or even Run DMC, you know? No. At that time. We didn't, but no. That was going on.
So, as is the style of chart music, here's the moment when we stop and rummage through some of the cardboard boxes and pull out an issue of the music press from this week. And this time I've gone for the February the 16th edition of the NME. Shall we leap through, chaps?
Yeah, let's have a look.
On the cover is a photo of a knee poking through some ripped jeans and the headline, Old Punk, New Punk, Rip It Up and Start Again. I think the NME's had enough of the music of 1985. In the news, the main story this week, according to the NME in any case, is about their current row with Mick Jagger's publicists over extracts of an interview they were intending to run this week but have now pulled after Jagger's press people claimed he should have been given full clearance on it first. They claim it was a pretty boring interview in any case.
Yeah. Well, it is the NME in 1985, yeah. So it probably would have been.
Gallup have announced that they will be installing their chart return machines in a handful of specialist reggae shops after Trojan Records complained that their reissue of 5446 Was My Number by Toots and the Maytals last year sold 60,000 copies without getting any chart action at all. A bootleg of a song John Lennon demoed in the summer of 1980, the Bob Dylan diss track Serve Yourself, has been spotted in certain record shops in London. An investigation conducted by Gavin Martin concludes that Fred Seaman, Lennon's former PA, who is currently on probation for nicking assorted personal bits and bobs, could be behind it. The article concludes with a footnote. Readers are reminded that as bootlegs are illegal, NME is unable to enter into any correspondence or phone calls regarding this record.
Have you ever heard that song? It's a typical weirdo Oedipal Lennon. It's all mothers with him. It's very creepy.
There's UK tours announced for The Associates, Grandmaster Melly Mel and the Furious Five, The Sisters of Mercy, Test Department and David Johansen.
That should have been one tour.
Yes.
Just 15 minutes each, all travelling in the same bus.
Yes.
A bit of value for money.
And Billy Mann reports a shocking development from Liverpool. The reintroduction of flares. It's actually more of a bootcut thing with Lee and Wrangler jeans and cords with 19-inch bottoms being snapped up across the northwest and a club night with a tribute band called Ground Pig who play Simon and Garfunkel and Lindisfarne covers and are becoming very popular across Liverpool. Oh dear, man.
It's starting.
It's disgusting, isn't it? Because, I mean, at this time, all the shady lads round our way started wearing Farrahs. And it was like, you'd look at them and go, they're flares. What the fuck are you wearing them for? Yeah. And they also made you have a really massive arse as well. Farrahs. They were fucking horrible. My dad had a pair. Mm. And that's why I didn't wear them. As soon as my dad's got some, I don't want to wear them. Yeah. In the interview section, Bieber Koff manages to spin out a very brief interview with the Jesus and Mary Chain into a centre spread feature with a big photo of the lads sitting on the floor, looking all sulky, taking up an entire page. He attempts to trace a link between Elvis and them, while they say things like, we don't want people to come away from our gigs and think, not bad, and point out that they don't like bands who tune their guitars on stage. Penny Real bumps into Barrington Levy in Stoke Newington and they reason about the reggae scene in London, his forthcoming push into the mainstream and why he covered How Your Panty Get Wet under the name Eccle and Jekyll while saying scene a lot. Because that's what you got to do with reggae artists. You've also got to reason with them, which makes them sound really unstable and potentially violent.
That persists with reggae artists, especially with like people like Lee Perry. There has to be the announcing first few paragraphs that he's a bit crazy and a bit mad, and we eventually got to some sense out of him.
Matt Snow and Barney Hoskins link up with Joey and Dee Dee Ramone for a chat about the good old days and why everything is so rubbish now. Joey reckons it's because kids these days are so shit scared about nuclear war that they don't give themselves the chance to live for today. He can't see the point of Duran Duran and Culture Club and points out that he's never been a conservative, while Dee Dee mentions that Debbie Harry is currently in a bad way. David Quanting drops in on the Monochrome set, who have just released the single Jacob's Ladder, and he's shocked that he's being played by Mike Reed. They try to wriggle out of Quantic's accusation that all their singles sound the same and, like the Ramones, bemoan the rubbishness of pop in 1985. I've got a few friends who are school teachers, and the information I get is that kids only seem to listen to two bands, Wham and Duran Duran, says lead singer Bid. I recall when I was at school, there were a million bands, a million directions. Meanwhile, Danny Kelly sits down with the Kane Gang to discuss the rumours that have been swirling around the biz about them. They claim that no Judy Zook satin tour jackets were used to get their last two singles into the charts, and the rumour that their recent gig in Liverpool only attracted 27 punters is bollocks. They're more keen to talk about their new LP and to also have a moan about the state of pop. Everything is geared up to beauty, press-ups and breakdancing, says Paul Woods. If I wanted to see that sort of thing, I wouldn't go to a gig. I'd go to a circus.
Yeah.
We saw Spandau Ballet on TV when we were in Germany. Three of them were stripped to the waist while Hadley led the audience clapping. And this is the band that started with all the arty manifestos about breaking the mould or whatever. They've become the status quo of pomp rock.
It's true though, isn't it?
The single reviews this week are conducted by Stuart Cosgrove, and he has three singles of the week. Doing Bad, Jamming in the Big M Town by Robert and Tom Sanders, which is an urgent and restless surge of party funk. You Got Me Hypnotised by CC, a soul ballad which is tragically great. And You Turn Me On by Bruni Pagan, a Latino cover of the Rick James tune, which is also produced and arranged by him. Anything that two-bit tosser Prince does, Rick James does better, says Cosgrove.
That's proper old school, though, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like, however wrong it is, you've got to let old Cosgrove have his head there, because that is authentic old school thinking. He really believes that with his in his loafers, with his closely shorn neck.
The double A-side Drop the Bomb, Pump Me Up by Trouble Funk is gleefully seized upon as the real sound of urban America. The former is certain to cause angst at your local CND, while the latter is a nod to the block parties of the Bronx. Fucking tune. Both of them.
Hmm.
War Dance by Funkmeister, the latest attempt to meld verbals to beats in the wake of No Sellout by Keith LeBlanc, this time utilising speeches from Hitler, Churchill and Lord Haw Haw, is routine, according to Cosgrove, who points out that the BBC, who own much of the original audio, have demanded that 2p per side is to be donated to the British Legion. However, it's a coat down for the Minor Strike rap by Michael Rosen, which is about as helpful to the strike as Hilda's new lodger.
Can you fucking imagine? Oh, I've got to hear that now.
No, I want to keep it as in my imagination, I think.
Contract of the Heart by Spelt Like This is given equally short shrift. The three-layered record sleeve is so complicated, it took 20 minutes to get the record out, only to discover a very ordinary pop song.
Yeah, it's all hype.
Money Changes Everything by Cyndi Lauper is brilliant rubbish. You're the Inspiration by Chicago is predictably uninspired. A cover of I Want to Know What Love Is by the New Jersey Mass Choir reminds the reviewer that Foreigner is still the best argument I've heard for xenophobia, and High On You by Survivor tastes of phlegm. In the LP review section, the main review is given over to What Else? Meat Is Murder by The Smiths. Paul DeNoyer thinks it's dead good. After calling Morrissey the natural successor to George Formby and meaning it as a compliment, he proclaims the new LP is the equal of the last two and could even be better in time, thanks to Johnny Marr starting to come to the fore. Although the title track won't make him change his diet, DeNoyer says, pop propaganda has really come so powerful. It's also a meaty thumbs up for VU, the long-awaited compilation of outtakes recorded by the Velvet Underground for MGM before they were dropped. 10 tales for everybody, 10 songs to shake the world, writes Matt Snow. VU belongs right up there between the third album and Loaded, a masterpiece and a good friend. Adopt it today.
Just try and ignore the disgusting 1985 remixes on every track, including putting gated reverb on Mo Tucker's drum tracks to make it sound modern. Yeah, they did. It's like creeping up on someone while they're asleep and dressing them in Ray-Bans and a shiny suit jacket with the sleeves rolled up to the elbows. It's like someone thought Velvet Underground fans wanted to hear that. You know what I mean?
They were trying to make it sound 80s, weren't they? Because I remember that's got I Can't Stand It Anymore on it, hasn't it?
And
it's got this big, thumpy, echoey 80s sound. And I remember hearing it in 85 because my sister was a big VU head at the time. I just think, God, this sounds so modern. And now I listen to it, I just think, this doesn't really sound that good, actually.
Yeah, well,
sounds really dated now.
Yeah, they've since put out the 1969 mix, and the drums quite properly, you know, sound like she's hitting a sofa, and it sounds much better. But yeah, I don't know what the thinking was. It's like they thought maybe a 1985 mass audience might hear Temptation Inside Your Heart and mistake it for In the Air Tonight and buy it by accident.
The Bad and Lowdown World of the Kane Gang by the Kane Gang is an attempt to catalogue the tedium of small town UK in much the same way as Uncle Brucey sketches his worm's eye view of living in the USA, according to Adrian Thrills, but the band's brand of earthy truth and justice testifying becomes dull and repetitive when stretched over an album. Never. Talk About the Weather by Red Lorry Yellow Lorry is as conservative as anything by Toto and as cliched as the Thompson Twins, but Matt Snow would still play it again and hopes they get rid of their rubbish name. While former Skids lead singer and current Channel 4 presenter Richard Jobson's second solo LP, An Afternoon in Company, is the first thing he's ever done that Jim Shelley actually likes. The gig guide this week. Well, David could have seen 999, UK Subs and The Exploited at the Lyceum, Mikey Dread at Dingwalls, The Pogues at Enfield Middlesex Polytechnic, Shalimar at the Dominion Theatre, Time UK at the Marquee, and Phil Collins's six-night stand at the Royal Albert Hall, but probably didn't. Oh, which one of them would David least want to go to?
I think the first one.
He'd probably get his nephew to record the Pogues for him and listen to it down the phone. Taylor could have seen Joan Armatrading at the NEC, Chumbawamba at the Darlaston Theatre Foundry, Stigma at the Red Lion, Joe Boxers at the Digbeth Civic Hall, or George Melly and the Feet Warmers at Birmingham University.
Ooh.
Neil could have seen Misery in Roots at Coventry Poly, Killing Joke at Warwick University, The Blow Monkeys and Then Jericho also at Warwick University, or treated himself to a night out in Wolverhampton to see Chaz and Dave at the Grand Theatre.
Oh man, my cut runneth over.
Sarah could have seen King at Hull University, Bad Manners and Amazulu at Leeds University, or Mark Riley and the Creepers at Leeds Beer Keller. Al could have seen Killing Joke at Rock City, the Commodores at the Royal Albert Hall, the Membranes at the Garage, Dawn Trader at the Hearty Goodfella, or gone to Chris Needham Land to see the Rubettes and the Glitter Band at Loughborough University. And Simon could have seen the Boomtown Rats at Cardiff University, Chaz and Dave at Cardiff St David's Hall, and fuck all else. In the letters page this week, Paolo Hewitt is at the controls, and he's had to deal with a backwash of responses to a letter printed last week, which contended that Band-Aid was a cod and the real beneficiaries were the evil pop stars who took part in it. The Star letter is written by John Halloran of Cambridge, who believes that we can chastise Bob Geldof only for raising a vast, urgently needed amount of money by somewhat devious means. So Midyor thinks that the miners have a choice in their destiny, as opposed to the Ethiopians who have no choice whether they starve or not, writes Tony Webb of Swansea. I, however, can choose whether or not to buy Ultravox records. I never have, and now I never will either. Meanwhile, Peter Coyne of the Sid Presley Experience is well dischuffed by a gig review by Andrea Miller in Glasgow, who responded to their cover of Cold Turkey by writing, "If I was a 16-year-old unemployed junkie, I'd resent some wanker with a record deal telling me about it." He points out that they didn't have time to soundcheck, as they had been on the tube that night and had only got to the venue half an hour before. The 750 or so people who were there that night demanded 3 encores, and she didn't mention in her review that she had spoken to him after the gig and didn't call him a wanker to his face. Miller could never do what I do, but I could do her job standing on my head. How about it, Neil? Neil Spencer, current editor of The Enemy. Hewitt responds by stating that if he does want a job at the NME, he could start by removing the graffiti he wrote in the lift and the office toilets.
I love that. Some wanker with a record deal. Like these children of privilege. The Sid Presley Experience.
Yes.
They probably lived in a squat. You know what I mean? But, oh, they've got a record. Yeah, with pint and milk records. They have to take the tapes to the pressing plant themselves on a big bike like the Goodies. Sell out.
Tony Parsons did the singles review page a fortnight ago, and people are still queuing up to put the boot in. Rusty James of Brighton thinks it's nice that the old bastard still gamely struggles up to town to help the younger writers while smelling of nappies and sick, while Jan Laskowski of Ealing coats him down for saying that Funky Nassau was originally recorded by Beginning of the End and not Cool and the Gang. Fucking hell, Tony. Even Jeff Travis of Rough Trade gets stuck in, berating him for slagging off the label in a review of the June Brides when they're not even on Rough Trade. How long will the NME continue to shout the praises of those dated rags, pathetically known as fanzines, says Edgar Rice Crispies of Leeds. The namby-pamby efforts currently circulated are either absolute shit or they're sub-NME brothel sheets with every weedy hag trying to be your next chosen disciple. Hewitt responds by saying, "Fair enough point, but wouldn't you be better actually writing to the people involved? You can find the addresses for Melody Maker and Sounds by ringing Directory Inquiries."
Ooh, cheeky little fucker.
Touché away.
Surprised Paul Weller let him say that. Yeah.
44 pages, 45p. I never knew there was so much in it. Although not as much as usual, I find. Pretty crap time to be writing for the music press, it seems.
Yeah.
Just everyone's harking back to the past, everyone's moaning about the present and doing nothing about it.
But, you know, I mean, now I kind of want to be a poptimist about 1985 and stick up for a little bit. But at the time, I remember feeling the same way as a Smash Hits reader that, yeah, things were shit. I mean, like, when you read out most of that stuff in The Enemy, it was about things are awful now. How are we going to make things better? Or how are things going to get better? Mm. And Smash Hits didn't avowedly say that. But as a reader, you go from early 80s years where, I don't know, every other page had some weirdo on it to the smug face of Paul King looking at you. Mm. And you know, those same haircuts and that same sort of bland professionalism and expensiveness everywhere. So it wasn't just the NME picking up on that. It was everyone. And even things like the Jesus and Mary Chain. You know, perhaps in another year, the Jesus and Mary Chain, you know, might not have been so special. But I remember in 85, that and, you know, Psycho Candy and that being special moments, yeah, and special things, because they were genuinely something, you know, a suggestion that there might be something else going on. Mm. Than what was usually popular, yeah, at the time. So we were all in 85. We were simultaneously lost in the past because we had so much reconnaissance to catch up on and just appalled at the present, mm, with these odd little glimmers. I'm glad I was 12, 13. If I was 10, I would have just fully, wholly accepted the mainstream in a sense. Yeah. But at the age of 12, 13, you can develop that little grain of resistance where you're looking elsewhere.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the NME famously declared war on pop only 5 months earlier at a Culture Club gig that Simon was at, I believe, in Birmingham.
Mm.
So, yeah, Simon's the Raggy Omar of music war correspondence there. Well done, Simon. I mean, they're already waving the white flag, aren't they, here?
Yeah, I mean, it should have been the triumphant sort of tail end of new pop, in a sense. But it isn't quite that, what's going on in 85. In fact, it's a kind of... those bands, Culture Club, Duran, Wham, they had become monsters. They'd become so big...
Yeah,
that regardless of what you thought of their music, as irrefutable and undeniable commercial facts, they just develop resentment because they were always everywhere and obsequious and omnipresent. And 85 certainly didn't feel like that. It didn't feel like that music resonated, really.
Yeah, the ladder had already been pulled up even before Live Aid.
Mm.
So what else was on telly this day? Well, BBC One commences at 6 in the morning with half an hour of CFAX, followed by a Valentine's Day breakfast time with special guest Richard Briers. When you think of romance, you immediately think Richard Briers, don't you? Then it's an hour and a half of pages from CFAX, Play School, and then 2 hours and 40 minutes of more CFAX.
That's more romantic than Richard Briers.
After the news and regional news in your area, it's Pebble Mill at 1. In Bavaria.
Ooh.
It's another chance to see Bob Langley and Paul Coyer arsing about on skis in Garmisch Partenkirchen, followed by Bagpuss, the afternoon show where Barbara Dixon looks at new initiatives for unemployed young adults in Derry, and punk hairstyles. After another hour of pages from CFAX, it's regional news in your area, Play School, The Family Ness, Tina Heath reads Cycle Star Appealing Tower in Jackanore, then it's Dog Tanyan and the Three Musker Hounds, Blue Peter, Dr. Kildare, the 6 o'clock news, regional news in your area, then Tomorrow's World examines the science behind kissing, and they've just finished the Paul Daniels quiz show, Odd One Out. BBC Two kicks off at 6:55 with 2 hours of The Open University and then 20 minutes of pages from CFAX. Then they plunge into 5 hours and 40 minutes of schools and colleges programmes. Then at 3 o'clock, they unleash a 2.5 hour CFAX data blast. Then it's Pride of Place, where the Marquis of Anglesey witters on about country houses. Then, at 6 o'clock, the catfish and the shape changer have a falling out and the earth quakes in Monkey. Fucking yes. Then there's a cartoon, and they're currently an hour into the 1955 Gene Kenny and Sid Cerise musical It's Always Fair Weather. ITV opens up at 6:15 for TVAM. Then it's a 2.5 hour splurge of schools programmes before The Little Green Man, Mooncat, The Sullivans, News at 1, Regional News in Your Area, Falcon Crest, The Magazine Show Daytime, then the fashion-based soap opera Gems, Sons and Daughters, The Little Green Man again, The Moomins, Sutter, the educational kids show Words, 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 Danger Mouse, Blockbusters, The News at 5:45, Regional News in Your Area, and Michael Knight is currently investigating the death of a racehorse in Knight Rider. Channel 4 starts at 2:25 p.m. with The British at War, 2 hours of World War II propaganda films. Then after Countdown, it's Sabrina Fair, the 1954 Audrey Hepburn, Humphrey Bogart and William Holden rom-com, and they've just finished Channel 4 News. Boys, 12 years old. Hoovering television into your eyes, no doubt. What's jumping out on that schedule for you?
Oof. Well, I mean, Falcon Crest, the scene of my sexual awakening, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously what leaps out massively is all that fucking CFAX. Good Lord.
Yeah, I'm looking at these listings. There's a show, which you didn't mention, called Assaulted Nuts.
Oh, that's later on.
Tim Brooke Taylor, Cleo Rokos, and Daniel How to Do It All Do It. Peacock, also responsible for Cave Girl, the closest thing we've ever seen to a soft porn children's series. It's like, I don't remember, who put those nuts together and assaulted them?
So, chaps, I believe that we've laid the table properly and put the knives and forks in the right order for this episode of Top of the Pops, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think we'll leave it there. We'll come back tomorrow with part two of Chart Music number 52. So, thank you very much, Taylor Parks.
Oh, jeez.
God bless you, Neil Kulkarni.
Toodaloo, mate.
Stay pop-crazed. See you in a bit.
Chart Music.